Russ Roberts, ladies and gentlemen, one of the true OGs of podcasting. And in fact, so OG that Russ is one of the medium's earliest adopters. Russ has been at this racket for nearly 20 years now, since he debuted Econ Talk back in 2006. And for my Nassim Taleb and Inserter podcast listeners, you undoubtedly are familiar with Econ Talk, since it is the single program Nassim Taleb has appeared on most. At this point, Russ has interviewed Nassim 10 different times on his program. So, before I preview this episode, I just want to again encourage you to take a leap that we in fact have more interests in common than we do not. My primary podcast is A Curious Worldview, and it was for that podcast which Russ agreed to talk to me for. So go over there, and I am sure that you will agree that our overlapping interests that extend beyond the Nassim Taleb will be served by that show. But to this episode here, although economics is literally in the title of Econ Talk, the show expands well beyond the narrow domain of theoretical economics. It is much broader and has transformed over the years into one of the most authentic reflections of a host's shifting curiosities. And in addition to Nassim Taleb, Econ Talk has featured Milton Friedman, Thomas Piketty, Christopher Hitchens, Michael Lewis, and so many more as well. In this podcast, you can expect to hear some of the following, primarily Nassim Taleb, whether Russ has ever got to speak to religion with him, what's he like as a bloke, and also Russ explaining in a very pithy fashion what he has learned from Nassim Taleb. We also remark upon Christopher Hitchens. For those listening to this that are familiar with my other work, know how strong an affinity I have for Hitch. But then finally, there is talk of serendipity and, of course, much, much more as well. So check out A Curious Worldview, refer it to a friend, of course, across the board, pump that good juice into the algorithm. But without any further ado, here is the great Russ Roberts. Russ, I just wanted to play this audio for you to begin with. It's the opening exchange you had in 2009 with Christopher Hitchens.
You start by saying that Orwell was right about the three big issues of the 20th century, imperialism, fascism, and Stalinism. Give us the flavor of what he was right about.
Well, to take them in that order, which is the order in which they occur, and also, I think, probably the necessary order.
So just that opening clip surmises for me why Christopher Hitchens was just such a phenomenal speaker and communicator. So he's famously one of the great speakers, so much so that he could take probably either side of any debate equally persuasively. Was he one of the best speakers that you ever talked with?
He's incredibly articulate. Most of my British guests speak very well. It's not a random sample of the English public, but they do are very good at expressing themselves, and he was exceptionally good at it. That was a very memorable interview for a variety of reasons. One, it was a bit of a stretch for me. Most of my interviews at that point had been about economics, and to drift into Orwell was a bit of an adventure. And of course, since over the years, I've drifted a lot away from economics into many, many other things. But at the time, that was a bit of a risk for me. And I was in Palo Alto, California, visiting Stanford for that summer. And Christopher Hitchens was also there. And I realized I could interview him. And basically, I had one day. It had to be that Friday. And I went out that evening, Thursday night, after he said yes, and bought Orwell Matters and read it, his book on Orwell. And, you know, it's a wonderful book. And we did, in those days, I occasionally did interviews face-to-face, now almost exclusively over Zoom. But I did that face-to-face sitting in his house he was staying at in Menlo Park around the corner. And it could have been a set for a movie. It was a strange and surreal experience, constantly interrupted by workmen and other people doing stuff on the house. So it was a very, I don't know if you can sense my unease in the experience. I also had to get the edits done that afternoon to get them to my producer. So after the recording was over and we just kept getting interrupted. So it was a crazy, intense thing. And I'm pretty sure he offered me scotch. The The interview was at noon, and I met him. We sat by the pool before we did the interview, and I'm pretty sure we had a scotch, which would be very Hitchensian, Christostophorus. Anyway, it was a really fun, very memorable interview. And he died, you know, way too soon.
Soon after that interview, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did he cut you his famous Johnny Black with Perrier?
I don't think there was Perrier. I'm ashamed I don't remember what the scotch was. I was a scotch drinker in those days, and it should have been more vivid. But yeah, it was probably Johnny Walker Black, but I'm not 100% sure. Mm.
Did you reach out to him? Were you booking your own shows in the early days?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I sent him an email, and fortunately he said yes. Mm. It's not the best sound quality, but because I wasn't very good at that then, but the content is spectacular, and it still gets a lot of listens.
It's phenomenal. You know, Hitchens,
thank you.
There's so much audio of him out there on the internet, and your interview with him is for sure in maybe the top five, in my opinion, of, you know, pieces of audio that he's ever been captured on.
Thank you.
You know, particularly the little sidebar about Orwell and Hayek, which you obviously jumped all over. Some really interesting stuff in there. Could you maybe explain a little bit more why it felt like a movie set?
It was a large house. There were there was a pool, and there were trees, big old trees, and as I said, there were workmen working on the house, and they kept coming through, and if you were going to film Hitch in America, it'd be a good place to do it. That documentary that never got made.
The reason why I decided to play that clip is just because of how quickly and aesthetically he reframes the 3 points you gave to him. And it's very informative, but as well, it's entertaining. It's beautiful. It's rhythmical to listen to. You said a lot of British people are like that. I would still put Hitchens right on top of that. So maybe underneath that question is asking you, how valuable is it to be a good talker?
Well, I think communication is underrated. And I think it's also denigrated a bit as obviously a form of show or marketing as opposed to the content. But I often think about the fact that the most famous economist of all time is probably Adam Smith. He was an extremely effective writer. And some of his ideas were not novel. They had been written about by other people, including by his friend David Hume. And I think part of the reason, not the only reason, but part of the reason that Smith is immortal is because he wrote well. I don't know how he spoke. I suspect he was pretty articulate also. But his writing and the clarity of it, the occasional humor, and the eloquence of it, I think is part of the reason he endures. And I think in general, writing and speaking are underrated. And of course, not everybody's good at both. There is, I'm sure you know, as a host, a brilliant writer can sometimes be a poor speaker. A mediocre writer can be a great speaker, and they don't always go together.
So, like you've identified at the end there, on the pie chart of communication, there is more than just writing or speaking or whatever. But I really want to ask you particularly about the talking component. How valuable is it to be a good talker?
I don't know. It's, you know, in our world in 2023, it's, I suspect, I was going to say it's more valuable than it was in 1759, but I'm not sure that's true. You know, in 1759, you didn't have any way to amplify your voice, both in the literal physical sense or the virtual sense. So your charm and eloquence as a talker would be extremely important. But of course, in today's world, because of the internet, an eloquent person, a great speech, a great presentation can have a huge effect. I sometimes think about David Foster Wallace's commencement address, This Is Water, that he gave at Kenyon College. It reads pretty well, but it's spoken extremely well. It's delivered extremely well. I guess that's orating, maybe you'd call that. In terms of talking, you know, I think there's two elements of talking. There's what you might call banter, the back and forth of two people who enjoy each other's company and are amusing and charming and thoughtful. And then there's the higher level for me is the ability to create something close to jazz, an improvised interaction between two people where something emerges that isn't intended by either one. You know, polite conversation means not talking while the other person's talking, but it's a big difference between not talking and actually listening, and not talking and being able to create new threads and directions for a conversation that weren't anticipated. So a great talker can do all that.
Is this something you're conscious of yourself? Do you check yourself and try to make sure you're speaking as elegantly, as clearly as possible?
Well, I live in Jerusalem. I moved here 2 years ago. My Hebrew is better, but not very good than when compared to when I arrived. And I have to still give a reasonable number of presentations here in Israel, either to my students or to my staff, my colleagues, who mostly speak Hebrew. They all speak some English, but they're more comfortable in Hebrew than in English, and I'm more comfortable in English than Hebrew. So when I speak English to them, I work very hard at avoiding phrases that I know that they will not understand. And that is a bit paralyzing. I know that because sometimes I'll speak to American audiences either back in America or here visiting, and I notice how more articulate I am. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, that's because I'm not censoring myself and being aware of phrasing and speed that I might have to focus on if I'm speaking to a non-native English audience. Also, as a podcast host, I'm very aware when I'm not at my best and when I'm better versus worse. And I, you know, if I'm tired and doing an interview too late in the day after too many other things, I struggle to stay linear. I can drift into what I would consider incoherence, which I find just depressing.
Where have we caught you right now?
Oh, I'm in a good space. I think I'm okay. We'll see. It's early.
You mentioned between two people. Obviously, that's a different dynamic when you're thinking about the straight up quality of good talking. But you mentioned jazz there. How often do you feel like you've reached jazz? You've done hundreds and hundreds of interviews by now. Are we talking right at the end of the tail, or maybe 10-20%?
No, I've done over a little over 900 interviews that are. Obviously, I've been in thousands, hundreds, 100,000 conversations, but in terms of formal interviews for Econ Talk, I think it's the far end of the tail. You know, I can be happy. I'd say I'm happy with most of the interviews. I'm glad. I think they went well, but there's a handful. You know, maybe it's 20, not two handfuls, four handfuls, 20 times where, you know, the interview ends, and in the old days, the technology was a little bit shakier. I would be recording on the phone with a portable recording device that talked to the phone system. And I never lost an episode, but I always had some unease about it. Now I do them over Zoom, so I have a backup on Zoom, the quality won't be as high, but, you know, I have a backup. And when I, there's a handful, maybe, again, handful is not quite the right word, but maybe 20 times I have this deep yearning that the conversation not be lost because I was happy that it went a certain way. And sometimes, you know, the ideal is a conversation that has an arc to it that could ebb and flow in terms of intensity and then builds into something more effective. Because often I'm talking to people I don't know and I'm talking to them for the first time, like we're doing now. It's hard. People are uneasy sometimes being interviewed and you don't have the time to put them at ease. And sometimes it just is choppier than you'd like. But a few times more than 20, you know, a story gets told that's precious to me that I'll cherish and I hope my listeners will like as much as I do. And that's the sweet spot. It's not quite the sweet spot. I spend more of my energy, perhaps mistakenly, trying to give the author or interviewee a chance to convey their ideas, their work, in a thoughtful and lucid way, asking clarifying questions. I don't necessarily focus on creating a great conversation. I'm thinking of myself in that setting as more of a teacher or a guide or a curious student would be a better word than teacher. The curious student and letting my listeners be the students who are listening alongside me. And that's different than trying to create, say, a magical interaction that's unforgettable. And so those are rare. And I think they'd be rare anyway. I'm not sure it'd be healthy to try it. It's probably better to let them come along when they come and not try to create them ex ante. But I wish I could get better at my craft. I know I'm better than I was 17 years ago when I started, but I'm sure I could be, you know, significantly better still. And I don't really have the time to hone that art other than just through practice and experience. I don't do it in a thoughtful way, and I wish I did sometimes.
Well, the sort of underlying theme of all of that goes back to what you said at the very beginning, which is communication. You feel like it's undervalued skill one could have. I would also say, and I have said before, it's the most valuable, transferable skill one could really endow themselves with. Your relationships become better. Your career has more opportunities. And then as well, you know, you can just communicate. The better you can communicate what you're thinking brain to mouth, and then also reinterpret what everyone else is thinking their brain to mouth, it just does improve your overall quality of life. So thinking about that, how are you teaching your kids to be great communicators? Since it's so valuable, as you've recognized.
Well, my kids are 23 years old and up. The youngest is 23, the oldest is 30. So most of what I taught them is water under the bridge, although I occasionally share insights that I think might be helpful to them even as adults. But I think listening is grossly underrated. So we've been talking about how conversation's underrated or communication. I think listening is wildly underrated. I think people spend too much time explaining, making the case for themselves, which we do when we're selling something or going to a job interview or often in just daily life. And I think it's a very human impulse to talk about oneself or to speak rather than listen. And so listening takes concentration, it takes focus, it takes an awareness, for me at least. It could just be me. It's hard to know. But in my experience with other human beings, it's hard to restrain oneself. So not talking is a low level, but the higher levels I suggested is listening, and what that actually means. And I think, giving people your presence, E-N-C-E, presence, is an art that isn't cultivated very well by our culture or our classroom or our families generally, classrooms or our family. So, you know, if I were to give young people, my kids, or other people advice, I would encourage listening, and then I would encourage curiosity, which is a form of listening. It's one thing to talk about yourself. It's one thing to talk about the other person. And asking questions, being curious about the other person, is a form of curiosity. For me, being a host of a podcast, very helpful. It was very helpful to me in cultivating my own ability to be a better listener. I'm not a particularly good listener. If you go back to the episodes in 2007, 2006, when I was first starting, and it took me a long time to realize that less was more, and it was a better just for my humanity and general skills. So, as you say, the relationships between family and others. There's certain, again, there's two levels of even that. One is you think of something to say and you restrain yourself. The higher level is to be so engaged with the other person that you don't have to restrain yourself because you're listening. There is a trade-off there. Conversation does stimulate ideas and responses. And I sometimes find myself, certainly as a podcast host, but often as a friend, thinking, oh, I should tell them about this. And then I worry, what if I forget it? And I think if you're not careful, you spend your whole time while they're talking thinking, don't forget to tell them, don't forget to tell them, don't forget to tell them. It takes a while to realize that if you forget it, it usually comes back to you. So you can just put it down and give the person your attention while they're talking, and you'll reclaim that nugget. It'll come back.
It's good to qualify as well that I wouldn't consider this what we're having necessarily, you know, a normal conversation, which I think podcasters, I hear them sometimes talk about it like it is. The fact is it isn't. It's performative. And it's also, there's a very clear power dynamic here. You're the person who we're here to see and we're here to listen to. So therefore, if the two of us were sharing a plate of pizza and hummus in Jerusalem, I mean, it would be very different, I think. I hear the dynamic of, like, you know, you hear something, you're like, oh, that's interesting. I want to return to that trunk of the tree while we go off on this branch here, but I can't just let this branch peter off into wherever it goes.
I think it's a good insight that this is a performative act that we're engaging in here. I think there are podcasts where people just talk to each other. I don't find them very interesting, and I suspect most people don't either. We don't really want to overhear the literal conversation. We want to overhear a stylized conversation, I think. Have you seen the series The Bear on Hulu? So it's about a tormented master chef who comes back to run his family's restaurant in Chicago. And I loved the first season. I thought it was spectacular. The second season I found very uneven, and although it's redeemed by one 35-minute episode that's unbelievable. But a lot of the second season is what I would call this kind of conversation that I said people aren't so interested in. It's a certain dance of phrasing and interruption and pauses and habits that people develop who talk to each other, who have their own specific verbal tics. And the show's very good at that. It's spectacular. The dialogue is amazingly vivid and real. But in the second season, I feel like they overdid that, even though I'm sure that's how they would have spoken if they really were in the second season of running this restaurant. But it just didn't work as well for me as the first season did. And I think I think it says something, you know, it's an interesting question in art, in fiction and in film, about, quote, the realism of dialogue. You know, some, and what I'm taking you to say, I don't know if this is what you meant to say, so I'll let you tell me what your brain is saying, but I think there's a certain sense in which great dialogue in movies and in certainly in fiction has to be somewhat stylized, not quite, quote, realistic, especially if we're reading it. It's a whole interesting question of how we read spoken, the spoken word in a novel or in a nonfiction memoir, say. Our brain makes some corrections, I think, for that, and misses others. And I think probably great writers are good at taking account of that.
I would agree for sure. It's stylized. And if it weren't stylized, it would be too close to everyday life that it wouldn't feel special enough to give it our attention almost.
Yeah.
If you think about Hitchens, the point you made at the end there, how you know, great dialogue and great writing read on the page, if spoken out loud, it's so beautiful and rhythmic and performative that it is special for that reason. It's not normal necessarily. And great talkers like Hitchens or this other guy I would enter into the equation, a fellow called Tim Butcher, another Englishman, they speak as if it is final edited prose.
Yeah.
One sentence complements the next. They don't reuse the words. There's rhyme to it. It's a fully formulated point throughout the entire thing, and it just flows out of them. And I, you know, I just stand back in awe thinking that's so incredible. Yeah. I aspire to that if possible. But to move it on a little bit, on your Mount Rushmore of great talkers, who is that?
Well, maybe I'll stick to my guests. Because I feel like I don't, I mean, I've seen some great speeches in my time, but that's, again, that's not really what we're talking about here. So, you know, certainly Christopher Hitchens would be one. A second would be Richard Epstein. I started interviewing Richard a lot in the early days of Econ Talk, and he has the ability, as you described, to speak in full paragraphs and pages. There's one interview I did with him. I think I was stuck for a guest. I haven't missed a week other than in the early days of Econ Talk, we took a break between Christmas and New Year's, and we only did like 50 or 51 episodes. But since pretty early on, I haven't missed a week. So, you know, it's been something like 600 plus episodes, maybe 750 that I haven't missed a week. And in the early days, I was often scrambling because it's harder to get guests when you get started. And I had I think I had to interview Richard Epstein, you know, maybe a day after or the day of another interview. I might have done two or even in the old days, I probably sometimes did three in a day because I was in trouble, and or the scheduling was such that that was the case. And I think it's on property rights. Richard's a legal scholar, and I asked him about some introductory question about property rights, and I think he talked for 10 minutes. And you know, in those days, I would often interrupt, and I would often interrupt because I was afraid it was going too long, it was getting, you know, boring, or, and I try to do that as little as possible now, but I didn't have to interrupt that. It's like 10 minutes of perfection. It's like he was reading it off a piece of paper, but it was still spoken. So that was masterful. And he's done that many times when I've interviewed him. I don't know if anyone else, I'll have to think about it, Ryan. If I come up with somebody else, I'd have to go through my list.
Nice. Okay. Well, maybe subconsciously the gears can turn and you can find one at the end. For me, this is a very Russ Roberts Econ Talk question, but it sort of just came to me as I was doing the preparation on this great communicator's part. Do you find that certain cultures have more good talkers come out of them than others?
I don't know, but I do think, I like to think, and it's just a speculation, that language itself is and the structure of language obviously determines some of that. My Hebrew is a much simpler language than English. And I would argue that American spoken American English is simpler than British English. Now, a footnote to that would be there's a lot of creativity in American English. There's a lot of new coining of phrases. But Hebrew has a much smaller vocabulary, and it would be interesting to talk to someone who is fluent in both, which I'm not, to see if they notice. I mean, for example, Israelis are famous for being blunt. Is that bluntness related to the language? Which direction is it run? Causation, it could be that the simplicity of Hebrew leads to a simplicity of communication style. You know, somebody told me recently that Israelis don't do lofty, meaning they don't like grand, eloquent, lofty formulations of things. And I like lofty. It's part of my toolkit, I attempt to use it. But it's an interesting question of if it's true that Israelis, quote, don't do lofty, you know, why is that? Is that the nature of Hebrew? Is that the nature of the culture? And of course, again, they probably work together. You know, you'd have to think about what Russian is like, what French is like, Italian. I don't know if, you know, as an American, European Romance languages sound so fluid and beautiful. Languages like Hebrew, German, Russian are more guttural and harsher to the American ear, but I don't know if that's fair. I've been watching, the other show I've been watching recently is The Extraordinary Attorney Woo, which is in Korean. And my wife and I watch it in Korean with English subtitles, and I love listening to the Korean. It's got a beautiful lilt to it. I think my vocabulary now is about 3 words. I haven't finished the show. It's 16 episodes, I think it is. But that's an interesting question. I'm sure there have been PhD dissertations written on it, but I don't have much more to say. Yeah.
I reckon I live now in Sweden, before the Netherlands, before Mexico, but I'm from Australia. And having had this, always sort of noticed this, I think there is for sure, you could say, some cultures that promote that loftiness or that aesthetic nature of talking above others. Like it's so flat, so egalitarian in Northern Europe that to differentiate your point, it doesn't rely on persuasiveness because everyone's opinion is equal. So it's not like, it's not, you know, sort of trained out of you. Whereas I think in Australia, you know, we're descendants of the Brits largely, but we as well have a much less sophisticated English than the Brits do, so similar to America. But Australia's created its own language as well, I think actually when used properly is one of the most, and this is my own proximity bias, but one of the most persuasive, funny, and like pithily great ways of communicating, get to the bottom of things.
I agree with that. I mean, I think it's easier maybe for Americans to appreciate it, but I think Americans find most Australians charming, and I think they feel the same way about English, men and women. They just sound better. Both of them, British and Australian. It's still English. There's no doubt about it. We understand every word, more or less. There's some words that are harder for Americans to get, but I think there is a fascinating love of a British accent for I think most Americans and Australian and South African and et cetera, the different parts of the old empire.
Yeah. Hitchens had this old joke that I have heard him roll out a few times. He lived in DC, I think from the 80s onwards. He was in his early 30s when he moved there and died in America. Died 62, 61. So had his career in the US. And he would get on the phone and some, you know, lovely person at the other end would be like, "Oh, keep talking. I love your accent." And Hitchens would say, "But it is you with the accent."
That's a nice line.
So although this might seem like a very forced transition, there is in fact a link between Christopher Hitchens and Nassim Taleb. Did you ever see the religious debate where they were on the other side of each other?
I may have. I've seen Taleb debate religion with someone. I don't remember if it was Hitchens. I just don't remember. It was pretty interesting, but I don't remember any of the details. Mm.
Well, it was fascinating to see it because, as well, I was surprised to see Taleb apply his risk philosophy management to religion. Because I personally would find that counterintuitive. But you've interviewed him 10 times and presumably had correspondence with him offline as well. Have you two ever gotten to speaking religion?
Not in a serious way. We talk about it a little bit. I've interviewed him a lot. I've spoken to him, you know, on the phone a few times, and I've hung out with him a couple. I've had the good fortune to spend some casual time face to face with him. I don't think we've had. I would say we've never had a serious conversation about religion. I would say the thing that distinguishes him from other intellectuals is he's very respectful of it. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that in his intellectual makeup and his personal life and so on. But, you know, in the modern world, a lot of intellectuals are not respectful of religion. So I know he's respectful of it. He's deeply interested in Hebrew and languages generally. So we've joked around about that, but I've never had a heart-to-heart with him about his personal beliefs or my own. Just hasn't happened.
Interesting. So not even a casual anecdote for him trying to get to a broader why we hear worldview question.
No, I don't think so. Maybe I've had enough wine with him. I don't know.
Sure. Yeah, you two need to dig into a few bottles of red and then hopefully it can all come out. It's funny with Taleb. I have met a number of people who know him personally. And everyone just says how lovely of a respectful guy he is, you know, open-minded, etc. Yet his online persona is the exact opposite. Do you have any thoughts on this that are worth saying?
I wouldn't say it's the exact opposite. I would say he's not the same person online as he is in person, and I think that might be true for many of us. And of course, we're not the same deep down inside as we are in person or in online, whatever that means. You could think of, I guess, as different types of performance, given, you know, the language we used earlier. But some people have asked me why I have him on my show. And the simple answer is I've learned a lot from him. So, and I continue to learn a lot from him. So, it's rare. There aren't a lot of people I've learned a lot from. Very few. So, most people, if I'm lucky, I've learned one thing from them. I've learned more than one from Nassim. So it's pretty. He's got a very high ratio there.
Having listened to you interview him now for several years, and as well the sort of commentary you have whenever Taleb is spoken about, I get the sense that he has actually been quite fundamental in shaping some parts of your worldview. And you said in your podcast with Tim Ferriss that you were working on an article explaining what you've learned from Nassim Taleb. Have you further organized your thoughts around this?
I've outlined it. I haven't written it down, but Yeah, when his first book came out, Fooled by Randomness, a lot of people, it comes back to our earlier point about communication. A lot of people said there's nothing new in there. I found it to be a revelation when I first read it, which is probably, I don't know, 15 years ago or so, something like that. And in theory, there was nothing new in it for me. I was trained as an economist. In theory, I understood something about randomness. I understood something about probability theory. But the reason I loved that book, and I recently reread it and studied it with some students here as at Chelem College as a lunchtime non-credit class. The reason I love that book is that the communications in it, the style, is so effective that you actually remember what you read. But more importantly, you absorb the lesson and have a chance to actually use it when the time comes that you need that lesson. And I think that's the highest level of communication. Very hard to do in conversation. It's easier to do in a book, but most people can't do it in a book. There are many, many. So if I made you a list of the things I've learned from, I'd say one example would be, you should spend a lot of time worrying about the downside risk. Okay. And we're talking, I was talking with my students. My students are 25 years old, roughly. They've been in the army here in Israel. Some have worked before they came here. So they're not 18. Is my point. They're not like an American college student. And we're talking about the downside risk and why it's so important. And they were puzzled, reasonably, as to why it's hard to remember. I mean, how could you not think about the downside risk when you're going through making a decision? There are only two sides to it. There's the upside and the downside. And surely they both should matter. And you know it's uncertain. You're not a fool. You don't think that it's going to work out for the best no matter what. Most people aren't that irrational or ignorant, meaning ignoring of the risk. And yet, I know it's hard. And one of the virtues of reading all of his books and one of the virtues of interviewing him many times and one of the virtues of doing that over a fairly long period of time is I've kind of drilled that particular lesson into my brain. So it comes naturally to me. It did not before. And so when my student says, why would it be hard to remember that? And I think the answer is, you know, what I told them was, you'll see. Live for a few years. You make a few decisions. You'll start to notice that you didn't think about it. But, I think the sensitizing yourself to that aspect of decision making is both crucial and hard to do. So that would be an example. But I just talked about it for what, a minute and a half, 2 minutes just now. If you're listening to this, you're thinking, yeah, of course. But the virtue of his books and the conversations I've had with him is that you have a chance to actually think of it when it's time to make a decision. And some of the smartest people I know and have known in my life have ignored those risks often in making those decisions. So you have to ask yourself, why, as my students ask, why would that be hard? And whether it's in business or your personal investing or your friendships or your the various decisions you make around day-to-day life, vacations, and so on. And I think it's actually quite illuminating to think about why it's so hard. But it's hard, trust me. So when I tell you, worry about the downside risk, and you say, yeah, I know that, of course, that's, it turns out, not enough. Just interesting.
So not only decision-making, where his books have been a constant reminder to you to measure the downside. But what about in more broader, how you make sense of the world? How you look at different domains being distributed according to extremist and mediocrist Dan. You know, how you look at things like the Lindy effect, how you think about the precautionary principle, via negativa, all these ideas that come from him. What other things have you learned from him, apart from remember the downside?
Well, those, it's interesting, the examples you gave, via negativa and the Lindy effect, I haven't absorbed those. I know they're in his books. I'm pretty confident I know what the Lindy effect is. But either I'm not 100% convinced of its universality, or I'm not sure of its practical application, that it isn't in that toolkit. That would not be one of the things that I would mention I've learned from him. I mean, in theory, I've learned it from him. I read the book, and I do remember it. And it has to do with the probability of something being around. The longer it's around, the higher the probability it'll stay around. Okay, fine, I got it. But I can't use that the way I use worry about downside risk for whatever reason. A lot of what I've learned from him is about, it's certainly not about investment alone or decision making. It's just about the nature of reality and the riskiness involved and the challenge of remembering your own biases. And there are a lot of people who work in that vineyard. A lot of that work I don't find interesting, but his I find very compelling for whatever reason. I interviewed UCLA econometrician Ed Lemer a number of times, very thoughtful thinker, and he has a line that human beings are pattern-seeking, storytelling animals. And I think that's a very powerful summary to think about the nature of ourselves, and it also reminds us of where our weaknesses are. And I think Taleb has done a superb job alerting us to the pattern-seeking impulse that we have. And again, he's not the only one. That's, I said earlier, people said, oh, there's nothing new in that book. A lot of people know that we're prone to see patterns that aren't there, but he writes about it in a way that helps me remember it. But, I think about my own life, my own sense of success or failure, judging the people around us. When you realize that there's a large random component in life, it changes how you look at the world. It changes how you treat other people. It changes how you see yourself. A lot of what I learned from him is a variant on that, which is, how do you consume information? How do you consume data? So when especially in today's world where data is so important, we're constantly tempted to overstate what we know and don't. What we know and forget that there are things that we don't know. And of course, by the way, we talked earlier about Adam Smith. One of my favorite stories that Taleb tells is the turkey who day after day is fed by the farmer's wife, puts out grain for him, and every day the turkey gets more information about the nature of his relationship with the farmer's wife. Obviously, it's very positive. She's feeding him every day. She's taking care of him. She's making sure he's doing well. And then the third Thursday in November comes, and turkey is eaten on Thanksgiving. Something went wrong there. What went wrong was that the underlying process that was producing the data, the information that was being consumed, was not accurate. It was the data misled the turkey into a hypothesis that was false, couldn't get out of that hypothesis, and saw all the subsequent data as confirming the hypothesis that the farmer and his wife were his friend. I think he got that story from Bertrand Russell. I don't think that's his story. I bet he tells it better than Bertrand Russell. and he uses it in a more rich and effective way. So again, that's part of his effectiveness is his communicating ability, his writing ability.
again, similar to what you opened up with, of how Smith maybe communicated the ideas of Hume a little bit better. Perhaps Taleb is also repackaging all of these old ideas, which he actually admits to himself. He doesn't pretend like these are his insights. It's rather just his distillation of them.
Having said that, I think there is a healthy amount of, or maybe a tremendous amount of novelty in his work. One of my favorite insights from him is that that people who do risky things remove themselves from the pool. So bad drivers get in accidents. Bad investors lose their money. And I've always understood as an economist that skin in the game is a powerful incentive. That if I know that my decision will lead to my reward or my decision will lead to harm to me, I'm going to pay more attention. His insight, which I've never heard until I read him, I think it's a novel insight, is that it doesn't matter whether you pay attention or not. It doesn't matter whether it affects your incentives. If you make bad decisions, you'll be removed from the game. You'll be removed from the pool. And so even if you're oblivious to incentives, skin in the game matters. And that's profound. I think about that quite a bit. As an economist, because we're obsessed with incentives. And he is saying that incentives actually are not as central in that domain as you might think. And that's a fabulous insight.
To really go a little bit deeper on that insight, could you tell the opening anecdote that you asked Luca Delana to give about his cousin skier? Which as well is just further like hammers that point deep into the base of your brain.
Yeah, it's a fantastic example, and it illustrates what we're talking about how communication brings us back to our first part of the conversation about communication. Also brings back Ed Lemer, the econometrician, who said human beings are pattern-seeking storytelling animals. We are storytelling animals, and stories are often how we remember anything. I wonder sometimes how little, I'm shocked at how little we remember of various things, and stories help people remember things. And when you started talking, you said, you know, the conversation with Luca Delana, thinking that was a few months ago, maybe a month or two ago when I recorded it, 3 months, I'm not sure. And I got a little bit of anxiety because I'm thinking, what if I don't remember that story? But of course I do, because it's such a good story for illustrating the point. The point is, when you look at skiers in a championship, you think you're seeing the fastest skiers, which is definitely a reasonable first thought. And certainly the winner of the championship is the fastest skier that day. But more than that, we think these are the best skiers. These are the fastest skiers in the world. And his point, and it's a little bit stylized because one could imagine disagreeing with this in various ways, but it doesn't matter whether it's literally true or not because it's deep. The truth is, you're not seeing the fastest skiers. You're seeing the fastest skiers who have not been injured and can't ski anymore. So the fastest skier might have been the fastest for a while, but then hit a tree, broke their leg, and never skied again. Because the reconstruction, they couldn't ski as fast after that. So his claim is, and this comes even back to yet another thing we've been talking about, is about the downside risk. The downside risk of, you ski quickly, you win the race. You ski quickly, you might lose the ability to be in future races. You take yourself out of the game. So the skin in the game, the fact that if you hurt yourself skiing, you might preclude yourself from participating in the future, is very effective, because the fastest skiers actually are eliminated from the competition because they get hurt in devastating ways. And the point that's important there that I want to emphasize, as again as an economist, very low level statistical thinker, is it's not just about the trade-off between the upside and the downside. That's the standard way it's discussed. scenario we just discussed is, well, if you go really quickly, you'll win the race perhaps, but if you go really quickly, you might hurt yourself. And so there's a trade-off. But the question is, what do you do with that trade-off? I mean, does that mean you should ski slowly? So obviously, the fact that there is a trade-off, that skiing on the edge of disaster is how you win races, but not past that edge, which, of course, is hard to find. And if you ever watch, I think it was Franz Klammer, the Austrian skier in the Olympics, if you ever watch his gold medal run in, I don't know what year it was, but you can Google it. You can find it on YouTube. It's exhilarating because it looks like he's on the edge of death constantly through the entire run. He's pushing the limits of his skis and himself. And the reason it's so exhilarating and moving and inspiring is that he's right on that edge. But the point is it's not the trade-off. The point is that you have to avoid ruin. If you don't ruin, meaning a loss so large, it's not, avoid losses, then you don't play. It's avoid losses so large you can't play later and take advantage of opportunity. So if you make what, you're wiped out, but not just wiped out in that race, wiped out from your career, wiped out from harmed, injured so badly you can't race again, which happened to Lucas Cousin, which is why it's such an effective, powerful story. You know, if you gamble recklessly in the casino, you cannot benefit from even the odds that are against you in a casino. The odds of the casino are rigged against the player. But a lucky player can win some evenings. A lucky player can win for some length of time. And a really wise lucky player can quit while they're ahead, perhaps, if it depends what your goal is. But if you stake all on the roulette wheel's color, the ball falling in red, and it falls in black, you're done. And you do not get the shot at the urn anymore. And that insight, which is what we've been dancing around, that is profound. And Luca, you know, wrote a lovely book on this, on the concept. It's a terrible name, is ergodicity. But he correctly, and he got it from Taleb and Ole Peters and others who've been talking about this. It applies to lots of things besides investing and playing roulette. It applies to your marriage. It applies to your friendships, right? Betrayal ends the game. There's some point where you can't apologize anymore and you don't get the shot at overcoming your poor behavior. So it's a really good lesson to know. Absolutely. I recommend learning it. The question is, can you learn it by reading about it or do you have to live it? Yeah. And that's a tough one.
So therefore, the ones who made it to the top, who won the skiing, are the great risk managers or extremely lucky, but not necessarily the best skiers. And that's like amazing for me earlier asking you about, okay, that's applying it to risk management, but what about your broader worldview? How do these insights actually inform how you live? So tell me, I want to get your gut check on this. You just mentioned applying ergodicity elsewhere. Gut check. Is this an application of ergodicity? And also, is this even true? And it's to do with podcasting. So, you know, you're recognized as one of the true OG podcasters and of having one of the great podcasts. I would assert that any good individual podcast episode is 80% due to the guest, 20% due to the host. However, a good podcast overall is 80% due to the host and then 20% due to the guest.
Yeah, I love that. Also, I giggled because there's so little that's OG about me besides maybe podcasting, so I always find it charming. And,
you produce rap videos too. I think there's a lot.
I
of
did,
OG
but that's us. Another. I have a couple aberrations in my work, but I think that's true. I think that's a great insight. I think, and it's complicated because, you know, if you run a good podcast, you can get good guests. And you can't have a good episode without a good guest. So that certainly matters a lot in that meta sense that you're talking about of a good podcast versus a good episode. I mean, it's a related question. I don't know exactly what you're getting at, but you know, after you do a certain number of episodes, you, for better or for worse, you get in a groove or a rut, depending on how you look at it. You're constrained, is the way I would say it. You know, there's certain things that listeners come to expect. I don't know about you, but you know, every once in a while I do something on Econ Talk that I'm a little bit anxious about in the middle of it. Typically, you know, reciting a poem, singing a song. I've done that a few times. It's not often, but I occasionally do that. And, you know, the first time I did it, I was pretty scared. I'm thinking, people are going to think this is stupid. Am I going to look stupid? Am I going to be off key? If it's a song, is it self-indulgent? And I'm sure there are podcasts where that's can't be done. It's just too weird. And maybe that was true of mine originally. I like it that I can step outside a little bit. I like it that listeners might hear something unexpected. But if that's all they got, then it might just be funky, weird, eccentric. And then it is 80% the host, though, and you don't get much of a, you don't get much positive effect of that. But I think that's true, what you said. You know, it's kind of like you could think about it as a TV show that has different directors for different episodes. So the writing is usually pretty constant, but if it is, and sometimes some people use different writers for different episodes too, but if you had one writer across the whole series, but you allowed different people to direct, there's a certain unpredictability about any one episode, but it generally falls under this umbrella of the arc of the show. And I think that's what happens in podcasting if you're around for a while. There's certain things that are allowed that you might otherwise not get away with and that listeners come to expect. And it allows guests to fall into that too, I think.
You're at the point now with Econ Talk, as is, say, Tim Ferriss with his show, as is, say, any top of the tail end of podcasts out there, where you're no longer tuning in for the guest. You are tuning in because you trust the host's curation enough that you're there for them. You're there for the podcast, for the experience. But early on, you're only going in for the guest. Sort of that, I think that as well maybe feeds into that dynamic.
Well, you know, my podcast is called Econ Talk. And after, I don't know, maybe 7, 8 years ago, I stopped having the main theme of the show be economics and started being a bunch of different things. So I added the tagline, Conversations for the Curious. And I think I've lost a lot of listeners who came for the economics originally. Some of them came to like the new stuff, but others wanted a Bitcoin episode every week or a monetary theory episode every week, and I disappointed them. And it both flatters me and depresses me that people will often say about an episode, I didn't expect I was going to like it and I was going to skip it, but I'm glad I didn't. And it's like, I guess I haven't earned enough respect from you yet. For whatever reason, I recently did an episode with a English sheep farmer about a book, a memoir he wrote about being a sheep farmer. It's a fabulous book. One of some of the best writing on nature. It's the author's James Rebanks. And it's a fabulous book, and I loved the book. I loved talking to him, and it didn't get nearly as many downloads as my average episode, and I assume that's because people assume it's either going to be boring or not interesting, and I'm thinking, you're missing out. Don't miss that one. It's great. I love talking to him, and I understand that everyone's not like me. That's a good lesson, right? I could be interested in sheep farming, and they're not, but anyway, you're right. There's a certain trust that I think does develop if you're lucky. But it's interesting to me how there's a lot of episodes I do people don't. They're just skipping.
It's also skin in the game, because if you had just continued to do monetary policy and Bitcoin episodes because your show was Econ Talk and your guests you were guaranteed downloads, then maybe the podcast wouldn't even still be around. You would have just gotten over it. I don't want to do this anymore. But rather, the skin in the game is it's following your authentic interests. And it might mean you have less downloads over time, but those downloads will matter more, I suppose. Like, that's the upside of having skin in the game.
Yeah, and of course, one of the lessons that we talk a lot about on the program, and I think it's incredibly important, is measuring things can lead to trouble. So downloads are what we tend to use as our measure of success in this business. We forget that that doesn't mean listens, but okay, it's close. It's correlated. So if it's going up, it must be good. But the things I cherish are the letters I get from listeners, which are, you know, occasional. Most listeners don't write. But occasionally I get letters that move me deeply and make me incredibly grateful that I'm able to have this, you know, the program I have. It's the best. It's much, the value to human beings, whatever that is, however small, is so much more important than how many people listen. But your brain looks at the chart and wants to see listening go up, downloads go up.
Yeah. But Russ, I mean, it really is the best. And as well, surely, as I'm sure you take this into account, but the serendipity that comes from the show is probably worth more than any type of financial upside you could ever capture from the show. Oh, yeah. Or fame or whatever. Who's to say whether you would have gotten this position you have now as president of a college in Jerusalem if, you know, you didn't have a very well respected show, global show. Who's to know? We don't know the false...
Correct.
Whatever it is, but yeah.
But I agree with you. I think that the things that have come into my life because of Econ Talk, Econ Talk is sponsored by Liberty Fund, which is a foundation of the United States. They have a fabulous set of economic education web pages, of which Econ Talk is part of, called the Library of Economics and Liberty, Econ Live. They produce gorgeous books, definitive editions of books that don't sell very many copies because they think it's important to keep them in print. And they run amazing conferences for people to get together and read and talk. And they pay me a little bit for doing Econ Talk. So there's a financial part to it. And I've never looked at whether I could make more or less doing it on my own separately. I have a relationship with them. They've treated me well. And so I'm totally fine with that. It is obvious to me, as you say, that the benefit of that program is so dwarfs the financial part. There's just so many wonderful things that have happened to me directly because of Econ Talk. You mentioned the Keynes Hayek rap videos. I did this with John Popola. I think they have 13 million downloads, views. Even if they're only 3 seconds, it counts as a view. I don't know. There may be a cutoff for YouTube. I don't pay attention to that. But, you know, John was a listener to Econ Talk, reached out to me in, I think, 2007 or 8. Wanted to do a project together. Didn't think anything would come of it, but tried it. And because of that, it's one of the most interesting and satisfying projects I've ever done, is to create those two rap videos. And just one thing. There's just, yeah, it's the more important thing, I should say, it's made me a much better person. Having to be a podcast host, it has made me, it's made me a better listener, and it has ensured an intellectual vibrancy that I don't know if I would have maintained if I had just done something more mundane. the number of people I've talked to, the books I've read, we talked about Taleb. There's so many others who have enriched my life intellectually and personally from understanding things. It's a great educational experience. Unbelievable.
How quickly can we do this? I got one more prepared question and three that I ask every single guest.
Yeah,
do you think we can do four?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So finally, to just round off Taleb in this particular chat, I think this is a novel idea from him, and as well, it'd be great to apply it to podcasting. Could you please explain why podcasting downloads are a domain of Extremistan?
I don't think so. You no. Tell me, Ryan.
No, I would say they're certainly a domain of Extremistan because...
Why?
I was in the top 5% downloaded last year in Spotify, and I can tell you it was probably the amount of downloads you would get in the first 15 minutes of publishing an Econ Talk episode, right? And that puts me in the top 5%. So I'm already at the tail end of the distribution, whereas yourself, Tim Ferriss, forget Joe Rogan and stuff. Truly, 99% of all downloads is captured by 0.0001% of podcasts.
Yeah.
I would say it's as firmly in a domain of Extremistan as anything else. That's why I asked the question. But I mean, I've answered it now. I think Russ, you got to be the one.
I don't
have
much
it.
To say about it. Sorry.
Okay. Well, then, no worries. Final three questions, Russ. I ask this to every single guest if I can. The first being, you've definitely already touched on it with the rap videos, but I would like for you to maybe look more into your personal life to answer this one. What is the role that serendipity has played in your life?
Yeah, the rap videos are just an example of it, but I think serendipity is underrated. To the extent it's thought about, I think it's thought about somewhat incorrectly. Branch Rickey, the general manager of baseball, who brought Jackie Robinson, the first black baseball player, into the major leagues in America, he had an expression, which I think is very popular among sports figures and I think in life, which is, and I think it says, luck is the residue of design. It's what's left over. But what it means is, if you plan enough and you work hard enough, then you can squeeze luck out of it a little bit. You can. That's what I always thought he meant by that. And I took that to heart in some intellectual sense. I don't know if I really took it to heart, but I think a lot of people believe that. Cover every base, prepare, work really hard. Do what a friend of mine calls best efforts. Leave no stone unturned. And I think that's it's pretty good advice, but it doesn't leave much room for serendipity. And if you're not careful, you miss opportunities for serendipity. My last book, which is Wild Problems, A Guide to the Decisions That Define Us, really makes the case for serendipity. It's Talebian, by the way. It's the virtue of being a flaneur, someone who strolls without purpose versus a person on a mission. And I contrast, the tourist with an itinerary versus a tourist who just hangs out in a local cafe or walks around a neighborhood. And I think serendipity, and maybe this is what Branch Rickey really meant, so I don't want to be unfair to him, but serendipity means making room for luck and putting yourself in a position and paying attention to things that might come across your path. I think I talk about this in my book, The Virtue of Saying No. There's a lot of self-help books and experts who say, you got to learn how to say no. And I used to think that was really good advice. It is, except when it's good to say yes, because things happen that you didn't expect or anticipate. And if you always say no because you think you know what's going to make you more productive by turning down this so-called distraction, you're going to miss a bunch of things. A lot of my life, as you suggested, and I think it's true of many people, is unscripted. The best things are often unscripted. Saying yes, doing something that is out of your comfort zone, doing somebody a favor that you shouldn't really rationally do, and something comes of it that you shouldn't rationally do it in the narrow sense of rationality, but something comes of it that you didn't anticipate that's delicious or profitable or just fun. That's delicious, I guess. So I'm a big fan of it. But I do think there's an art to making room for it. It's a good idea.
Amazing, Russ. Thank you. And I'm sure you understand. I could go on about that a lot more, as I'm sure you could as well, because it is so deeply wrapped into the richness of life. You know, just say yes, you know, go to that, you know, go meet that person, you know, shake off the laziness and actually go and do it. And you just never know what the upside could be. And actually, it might be something I could share with you at some point in the future, but after having recorded 150 episodes now and asked that over 120 times, some of the stories, it just reaffirms this idea that how can you predict a future of infinite possibilities based off a finite experience of the past? You just are, you're at the whims of random chance. And the best thing that ever happened to you is probably going to be because of some random chance, because you optimize for serendipity.
Yeah, the economist in me would say, and I think the economist in me would be wrong, but the economist in me would say, yeah, but if you say no to that, you're saying yes to something else, and it's all life. But often these are things that are outside your comfort zone, that are different, that you can find excuses for not doing. And most of them turn out pretty well. Mm. I like them.
Two more for you, Russ. What is a country you're particularly bullish on?
Not many. It's a tough time for the world. Where I live, Israel is going through a huge political fight over, on the surface, it's about judicial reform, but it's really about the identity of the country. And it's a very complicated situation. Israel's one of a handful of countries that doesn't have a constitution. I think constitutions are overrated. Most people, countries that have constitutions don't pay any attention to them. So the challenge isn't to have a constitution, it's to have one that you actually live by. And most countries don't. And it includes the United States. I like to say that the First and Second Amendments in the United States are still somewhat binding. The rest, not so much. So Israel's having a tough time. But it's a remarkably joyous place when we don't talk politics. And it's a remarkably family-oriented place. And that gives the country a different kind of texture. So I'm bullish on that part of this country, whether it can overcome the political issues that we're struggling with. And bottom line is, We need to figure out here what the rules of the game, political game, are. The Constitution is one way to do it. Again, if it's kept and observed. But I'm guardedly optimistic that Israel will overcome that issue. We'll see. But so many other countries have their own, remarkably new sources of upheaval and challenge. I'll just quote James Buchanan, the Nobel laureate in economics. He said, when I look to the future, I'm a pessimist. But when I look to the past, I'm an optimist. And by that, he meant, when you look to the future, it sure looks depressing. Or populism is on the rise. We're angry. Everybody's polarized. They're disrespectful of each other. They can't put themselves in the shoes of people who feel differently or think differently about political issues. That's very common. Certainly it's been made worse by social media, but it's a fundamental human challenge. So the future doesn't look so good for the world. But you look to the past, you're an optimist. Think about 1933. That looked pretty bleak, and it came out okay. So, you know, the world, a lot of people died. It was a horrible stretch between 1933, say, and 1945. But the world got a lot better after that, at least in some obviously measurable ways. Maybe it's not so good in other ways. But so I, you know, thinking about it, maybe it's just not the right question. I think it's useful to think about it, but it might be useful to think about whether it's a meaningful question. I started thinking about this because of progress. Like, as an economist, the world's richer. We have a higher standard of living. Is life really better? Well, it is in the sense that we live longer. We can see our great-grandchildren more likely. We can play tennis at 75 with an artificial knee. A lot of benefits from our standard, higher standard of living, and many, many more people have access to that than did in the past. So are you bullish about the world? Well, somewhat. I see lots of bad things going on too. Despair, suicide, drug use, immersion in the virtual world to the exclusion of real human beings. So it's complicated how whether the glass is half full or half empty. I mean, I like the question, right? Don't take it personally.
Russ,
maybe think about it.
It does sadden me a little that you have, it seems like, a rather pessimistic view of the future.
I'm old.
Yeah, maybe.
I think old people get, I don't know. I'm not actually pessimistic. I just know I'm not as optimistic as I was when I was younger. Mm. It could be because of my age, or it could be because the world's gotten a little more weird. So, I don't know.
Or your proximity to what is very real stakes, political violence and tension and all the ugliness that humans can.
Yeah. Know, and I didn't mention we're surrounded by people who want to kill us. Life here is very significant.
Yeah.
Life in Israel is, everything here matters.
Yeah.
For good, for better, for worse. It makes life very rich and very, dynamic and alive. You feel very alive here. But it's an intense place.
I just want to put this out there, and feel free to dodge it, but have you gotten any closer to a pithy response to what is a life well lived?
No.
No.
I don't think so.
Okay then, Russ. Our final question.
I don't have one.
If you could witness a conversation between any two people of history, dead or alive, no language barrier, so you're listening to a podcast, who's it going to be?
That's a tough question. The easy answer for me, and I'd have to think about it to see if there's a more interesting answer, but the easy answer for me is I'd like to have a scotch with Adam Smith and David Hume and hang out with them. They were lifelong friends. They were interested in the human condition in such a profound way. And I think they had a deep mutual respect. It'd be fun to hear them talk. And there's a story that Smith was late at a dinner party, and there were British statesmen and abolitionists and others there, and when he came into the room, I don't know, in my mind there's 25-30 people around this big rich London table, or Scott, I think it was London, and when he walked in they all stood up and he went like, oh, you know, what are we going to sit down? And the statesman, who I'm blanking on his name, I'll remember it in 10 minutes, he said, oh, you know, we are all your students. And I think Adam Smith had incredible curiosity, as did David Hume, and it would be really fun to hear them just have a conversation. I don't care what it's about. I'm sure it was interesting.
Thank you, Russ Roberts, mate. This has been a really highly anticipated moment for me for a long time. When I first started this 3 years ago, I had a list of, you know, sort of dream guests. Not a long list. There's probably 15 names on there, and you're one of them, because you were probably my gateway into podcasting. So Yeah, it really is an honor. Sounds cliche, but really, it's a huge thrill and pleasure for me. So thank you, Russ.
Thanks, Ryan. My pleasure. It's delightful.